This program, brought to you by Gary Allen Communications, was recorded in Pasadena, California, in early October 1973, just 1 week after the release from the publisher of Mr. Sutton's latest book, National Suicide. In bringing Mr. Sutton to you, we would like to give you a little background of him, as well as a statement from the preface of his new book, written by himself. Anthony Sutton was born in London in 1925, educated at universities of London, Göttingen, and California, and in 1962 became a citizen of the United States. Formerly a professor of economics at California State University at Los Angeles, he is now a research fellow at the Hoover Institute on War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University. Mr. Sutton has written for Human Events, The Proceedings of the U.S. Naval Institute, Triumph, Ordnance, and National Review. Among his several books are Western Technology and Soviet Development, 1917 to 1930, Wars and Revolutions, A Comprehensive List of Conflicts with Fatalities, Part 1, 1820 to 1900, and two forthcoming titles, The Soviet Merchant Marine and Collectivism and War. Mr. Sutton is married and has two daughters. And now we would like to take just one moment to read to you a brief notation from the preface to his book. The evidence and the argument in National Suicide, Military Aid to the Soviet Union, will come as a surprise and perhaps as an unwelcome shock to almost all readers. It is a first attempt to penetrate what may ultimately turn out to be one of the most tragic stories in the 200-year history of the American Republic. And now we join the program as Mr. Sutton is being introduced to his audience.
I'd like to introduce to you Tony Sutton, Professor Tony Sutton.
Thank you very much, Marion. This is the most unusual layout I've ever encountered, where I have people on three sides. And I hope you will excuse if temporarily I seem a little vacillation from left to right. What I'd like to talk about this evening is my latest book, National Suicide, which truly is hot off the press because it, I think, is only due to be released this week. Now, it should be easy for an author to talk about his own book. And usually I think it is. But this one is difficult, because if ever an author did not want to write a book, I am that author, and that is this book. The book itself is a book of facts. There's an introduction. There's chapter 13, where I draw together some threads and conclusions. But essentially, it is empirical observation, and in my experience, I've worked on this thing for 15 years now, nobody has yet challenged me on the basis of fact. Nobody. And my visitors include visitors from the Soviet Union, from Poland, from the Pentagon, all over. No one has yet said Sutton is wrong on a fact. And if you ever hear of anyone, I'd like to talk to that person. Now, how can I summarize 15 years in, what have you given me, 1 hour? I'll do my best. Let me first go back 15 years and tell you how I came to write National Suicide. In other words, paint the background to this picture. And then, very briefly, I'll tell you what the book is about, and if we have any time left, perhaps I'll try and fill in some of your questions. Now, the threads of the story, I can pinpoint the source quite exactly. 1958, Salt Lake City. I was in a motel. It was a snowy weekend. I had nothing to do. I went down to the only bookstore, I think, in Salt Lake City. The only book that to me looked interesting was a book by Leon Trotsky. Probably been sitting there for 15 years because no one else had bothered to read poor Leon Trotsky. Well, I bought the book and I read it. And I was intrigued. Because Trotsky was writing about Soviet Russia in the 1920s. And Trotsky was in charge of foreign concessions in the Soviet Union. And I had never heard in standard history of foreign concessions in the Soviet Union. It's just not in the history books. This is where Western firms went into the Soviet Union and built the first five-year plan, the second five-year plan, and so on right down to today. There's nothing in the history books about this. It was directly opposed to everything I thought to be true. Now, Trotsky, of course, is a communist. Lies can be truth to a communist. But there was something about the book that rang true. I knew, because I had a technical background, that you just do not build steel mills and nitric acid plants from scratch. There's got to be a technology. There's got to be a lot of technical work, design work, preliminary work. You just don't start and build a five-year plan. Obviously, they got the technology from somewhere, so I started to dig into it, and that's a long story. By about 5 years, by the early 1960s, I knew that I had something which had not previously been reported. But there were gaps in the picture that I was beginning to outline. What broke it was I managed to get access to the State Department files, and I think they've regretted the day that they ever let me into the State Department files. And the story that I was developing in the early 1960s was that all Soviet technology, or at least the greater part of it, came in fact from the West. It was the product of Western ingenuity, of Western enterprise, of free enterprise systems. This had been blacked out, and that's very easy to check, because if you take a look at my argument, you'll see nothing about it in the standard history books. The Soviet Union was actually built by Western technology, by Western firms, and by Western enterprises. Now, 10 years ago, I was a professor of economics at what is now Cal State University, Los Angeles, and as you know, being a professor of economics beats working for a living. And consequently, I had quite a fair amount of time to spare. The students kept out of my hair. Going a couple times a week and give a few lectures. So by 1966, I had the first volume written. It's called Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, 1917 to 1930. The second place I sent it to was the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. They accepted it right away. It was published in 1968. This, by the way, is the all-time... I'm not bragging, but I want to fill in a picture, because this becomes important later on. This is the all-time bestseller in the Hoover, in the history of the Hoover Institution. Up to that point, I had not been able to get backing from anybody. I was even naive enough to ask the Council on Foreign Relations. I thought this was a research outfit, and they were very polite and said, no, we can't help you. So that was my money that went into that thing. But I'll give credit where it is due. Hoover Institution picked it up and ran with it and brought it out in 2 years. Then I went to work on the second volume, which was 1930 to 1945. I was still teaching. The last part of this was written at the Hoover Institution. Again, it was brought out very quickly. By 1971, the second volume was in print. Then I went to work on the third volume, which covers the years 1945 to 1965. That was finished 3 years ago. It was accepted for publication 3 years ago. It is not available today. It was scheduled for publication early 1972. If anybody wants to challenge it, I have the page proof, and I can send you a Xerox copy of the title page with the copyright date 1972. In other words, Volume 3 has been ready for publication for 3 years. It has not been published, through no fault of mine. You can make what you like of it. I just state the facts. So what I've got, then, are three volumes published at Stanford. They are a precise technical examination of Soviet technology and industry. I take each Soviet process in turn. I trace back the technical origins. I'm not going to bore you with it. But just to give you an example, I will take the iron and steel industry, the classical blast furnace process. I'll look at the Soviet blast furnaces. I'll trace back the origin to the West. It's this kind of thing. Very precise. Let me give you another example. I know that exactly 68% of the Soviet merchant marine has been built in Western countries. I know that 82.1% of the marine diesel engines in these ships have been built in the West, and the other 20% were built in the Soviet Union at Bryansk and Leningrad under Western technical assistance, under Western license. They've got 6,000 ships. I probably know more about their ships than you know about your automobile. I know the cylinder diameters, the piston stroke, the model numbers of every diesel engine, every engine, every Soviet ship. I didn't get the information from Washington. I had to get it from the Soviet Union, a socialist country with apparently complete censorship. Now, you can be the judge, because what I did in National Suicide, I have reprinted the list of Soviet ships used to supply Haiphong, 96 of them. And the list is here, and I've listed the name of the ship and its Soviet register number and where the engine came from and who built it. It's all there. That's Appendix A. So you can judge whether I'm giving you a fair story or not. In general, then, I found that, if you want a ballpark estimate, I found that about 90-95% of Soviet technology came from the West. There is some Soviet technology. For example, medical sutures, they have a little wound stapling machine, which I think sells even in the United States. There is some, but not too much. Their best work, I'm not saying the Russians are stupid, their best work is in pure science, mathematics, science. They cannot innovate because of a statist, centralized, central planning system. It is the system that stops innovation, not the lack of Russian ability. The Russians are just as capable as you and I. Now, my first two volumes were reviewed quite widely. Again, I'm not saying this to build up myself. I don't have to. It's part of this picture. Reviews from France and Germany and Holland, but I can't read Dutch, so I don't know. I think it's good because I know enough German to... I think I know what they're saying. Those from France and Germany are excellent. They are enthusiastic. For example, I've just read one from France which says, if all American scholarship can maintain this standard, then it is from America that we will see the definitive works on world communism. They don't know quite what the American academic institution is doing to me, but we'll get into that later. Those from the United States are much less enthusiastic, and of course those from the Marxists are a bit sour about the whole business. Oddly enough, some of my most interesting visitors come from behind the Iron Curtain. And not one of them yet has challenged me. They accept what I say. They know what I'm saying is the truth. Now, here we get to the crux of the problem, why we're here tonight. By 1968, it was obvious to me that the Soviet military-industrial complex also originated in the West. Not only the economy, but the military aspect. And this military complex was integrated with the so-called civilian economy. Now, what they say in Washington is quite different. They say, no, there are two separate structures. You've got a military structure, and you've got an economic structure. And if you deal with the economic structure, this has no effect on the military structure. This is nonsense. And I think they must know it. Because I quoted in National Suicide examples where the Soviets themselves say that the two structures are very, very closely united, and indeed that imports, the first priority in imports goes to military goods. But there's another point here. All military goods need industrial products. You don't just have a machine that turns out tanks. You make a tank out of steel, out of aluminum, out of nylon, out of plastics. These products are also used in the civilian sector. You don't have separate steel mills for tanks. Of course not. You just buy your steel from the civilian so-called economy that uses slightly somewhat different specification. So your civilian, I call it civilian, your civilian structure is actually in any country the basis for its military output. And this is the core of the problem. Now, let me bring this right home to you very, very quickly. I use what I call the bullet example. This is a bullet. It's been fired. Normally, it has a back end on it, which has a propellant charge. But it gives you an idea of how you can pin this thing down. A bullet has a jacket, which this one happens to be cupro nickel, copper and nickel, and it has a little back end of it, which has a propellant, which is normally nitrocellulose. All right, take the nitrocellulose first. And most men, by the way, get killed by bullets or shells, which are just big versions of this. Where do the Soviets get their nitrocellulose? Well, it's in National Suicide. I've got the names of the companies. DuPont, Hercules Powder Company. And the Hercules Powder Company knew that the plant they were putting in was for military purposes, because in the State Department files I found their letter in which they said they hoped they'd get permission to ship it, even though it had military potential. I've given you in National Suicide a list of the ammunition used in Vietnam. I've given you the propellants used, whether it's tubular cellulose, the different types of nitrocellulose. And I tell you in there where they get the nitrocellulose from. In other words, you can pin this thing precisely back to Hercules Powder Company and the DuPont Company. The front end of this thing is basically copper and nickel. Their nickel technology comes essentially from the International Nickel Company, and in my second volume, Western Technology, that is pretty well shown. Their copper mines were developed by, as a matter of fact, by a Los Angeles company, Southwest Engineering Company, which used to be, I think, down on Figueroa Street. They went in the 1930s and developed their mines. So anyway, you can take a thing like a bullet. I could go on just on a bullet for a couple of hours, but we just don't have that time. You can trace this back precisely to a Western origin. Now, this is the core of the problem. You cannot separate industrial technology from military technology. It's intimately integrated. Now, when you sell to West Germany or Great Britain or Australia, you don't worry whether the product has any military application, because these countries have no hostile intent. And intent is the major word. What is Soviet intent? You first got to look at that. If it's peaceful, then it doesn't matter. You can ship them machine guns. It doesn't matter. If it's hostile, then you don't ship them anything. You just leave them alone. Now, back in 1968, this was the position I was in, to pick up my story again. We had a war going in Vietnam, which was being supplied by the Soviets. We had an administration in Washington that was repeating the 50-year myth of peaceful trade, and I've shown here a brief history of this 50-year myth. In other words, Washington was stoking up the war indirectly. It was shipping into the Soviet Union. The Soviets were using this technology to manufacture arms, going to Vietnam, completing the circle, coming back and killing Vietnamese and Americans. Let me give you a couple of examples. American pilots over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, they made comments that the Soviet trucks run by the North Vietnamese look like American trucks. They look like Ford trucks. What the American pilots didn't know was that they were Ford trucks made by Gorky. GAZ is the symbol. GAZ 69, the whole series of model numbers with that prefix. Gorky was built by the Ford Motor Company. The equipment has been consistently brought up to date since the 1930s. And what worried me very much was in 1971, while Gorky trucks were on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, I could trace a shipment out of a New York company going into the Gorky plant, more machinery. In other words, I could precisely identify, even without government information, because obviously I don't get that past a certain point, I can precisely identify the circle. You stoke it up at one end, it comes back and hits you at the other, and you wonder why you can't stop the war. Of course you can't stop the war. The more you stoke it up, the more they're going to keep it going. So in 1971, I could see that there was a very real problem here. I suspected that perhaps my volume 3, I didn't know, I suspected that perhaps it was going to be held up. In 1971, I wrote to the Department of Defense. And I said, will you declassify enough files for me to write one or two volumes giving the military version of my three-volume economic study? a sequel to the Stanford series. I received a reply right away asking for a list of the files, and I went right back. Mostly I asked for Russian technical manuals, Russian reports. They've got all this stuff. Nothing secret. Didn't want anything later than 1965. I can figure out the rest of it. I didn't want anything on lasers or anything esoteric. Just the bread and butter weapons. Tanks, aircraft, this kind of thing. I heard nothing. I waited 5 months because I knew what they were up to. All they wanted to know was how I was going to go about doing it. I waited 5 months. I wrote them a little letter. What are you going to do about it? They said nothing. You can be the judge, because I reprinted the correspondence with the Department of Defense. My first letter was to Melvin Laird as Appendix A of National Suicide. And you can judge for yourself my correspondence with the Department of Defense. So that was my position, middle of 1972. Obviously, I wasn't going to get very much assistance to write the military version. I sensed, I had no proof, I had sensed that this was not going to be a particularly welcome study. Then I had an opportunity. American Conservative Union called me and said, you want to go to Miami Beach and give 15 minutes testimony? I said, yes. This was a surprise, I think, because for 10 years I kept away from everybody. I only very recently started to emerge. I wanted to complete the thing before I emerged. I went to Miami Beach, subcommittee number 7. I made a statement, no questions. The only meeting I've ever had in my life where I had no questions. And I can tell if an audience is hostile or not, and that audience of Republicans was hostile. I won't name their names, but I can remember their faces and I can remember their names. And I know the degree of hostility, and I know why they were hostile. I don't blame them. It's the second most hostile audience I've ever had. The worst one was when I tried to preach laissez-faire economics to the American Trucking Association, and they did not like that at all. So that was my position. The Republican Party obviously didn't want to know what I was trying to tell them. But I knew what was going on in Vietnam, and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. We've got a bunch of elected officials here, and they're plain irresponsible. That was my interpretation. So the position last August was, I had very clear understanding, don't go down that road. So I sat down. I weighed up the situation, the pros and the cons. And I sat down, and national suicide was an idea this time last year. I hadn't even sat down to write it. I wrote the book in 3 months. I had most of the information in my files. Arlington House accepted the book and sent me a check within 10 days, which is fantastic. Any author will tell you that. You just don't get books accepted that quickly. Arlington House moved with that thing. They had galley proofs out in 10 weeks. I had advance copies by July. So I cannot fault in any way Arlington House. Now, what's in the book? If you want to pick up the rest of the Hoover story later, I rely on your questions. We can either forget it or you can pick it up. What's in the book? My theme is that 100,000 Americans and countless allies in Korea and Vietnam were killed by our own technology. Nothing less. This technology was transferred to the Soviet Union under the guise of peaceful trade. I name some of the corporations. I'm naming some of the businessmen. But I would emphasize one thing. You cannot condemn American business on the basis of this book, because 99% of American businessmen, I'm quite sure, do not know what is going on, and if they did, they would feel exactly as I do. Further, I think the book has nothing to do with partisan politics. It should be equally of interest to everyone, whether you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative. Come to that, it doesn't matter if you're American or Russian. Because to me, it comes down to a plain question of individual rights versus the totalitarian state. So my appeal in National Suicide is to those who have open minds, who can judge facts for themselves. What I'm saying here, and this came about by accident, is what Andrei Zakharov, the Soviet H-bomb scientist, said a few weeks ago. and the American press picked it up. Zakharov said, "You are fools. Your trade is building up the Soviet Union. The Soviets are using it to build a bigger military establishment. Détente is a phony." He didn't use the word phony, but in effect he said that. I can't even think what it would be in Russian right now, but still. What I'm saying here is, what I've got in here is the empirical backup to what a very brave Russian tried to tell the United States. And what happened? Read Mr. Kissinger on Andrei Zakharov. He's a Russian, and he'll pay for that. A Russian saying trade solves Soviet problems. We have no intellectual freedom in Russia. I'm going to end up in a mental institution because I said this, even though I'm probably the best-known physicist in the Soviet Union, certainly in the field of atomic energy, atomic weapons. What does Kissinger say? Ignore Zakharov. You mustn't interfere in Soviet internal affairs. We might disturb the Russians. It's an odd situation. A Russian warns the United States, and the United States ignores the warning. So let me very briefly tell you what I've got in the book. I hope it won't put you off reading it. I'll take that risk. First of all, I got a brief introduction, kind of a warming up thing. Oh, by the way, right in the preface, I say that why I've written the book, that I was denied the information from Department of Defense, and consequently we have censorship, and I point to Operation Keelhaul as another example of censorship. And that my hope is that the public reaction to this book is going to blast loose enough files for me to write the academic version. So in the first chapter, what I've frankly got here, I've outlined the history of so-called trade, what I call the détente aggression cycle. In other words, what the Soviets do, you can see this going back over 50 years. They are aggressive at one point, say in Korea or Vietnam, and then they plead peace, and this détente phase is used to bring in more technology. And you can identify this. They act peacefully. They say, let's live in peace, détente. They did this in the early 30s. The United States goes in there, builds it up. The American taxpayer pays for it, 2 credits. Then they turn right around, and you get another war going. It's a cycle, and you can identify this cycle, and I've begun to identify it in this book. And then I talk about the persecution of Russian Jews, Russian Baptists, and Lithuanian Catholics. I'm neither a Jew, nor a Baptist, nor a Catholic. But these people have a right to live. They have a right to their religion, and I feel very deeply about their persecution. And so I have brought this in to show that if you think the Soviets have mellowed at all, then go and talk to some of these people. Then I've got various sections on the link between casualties and trade, which has not, I think, been pointed out before. They say, as you trade, so there's a greater inclination to peace. Well, I've got a little diagram in here which says, the more you trade, the greater your casualties. The black marks are the increase in casualties, and there's a line showing the increase in trade. In other words, according to my analysis, the more you trade, the more casualties you get. But of course, this is lost in Washington. Then in Chapter 4, we get right down to facts. How we built the Soviet military-industrial complex. Who built it? It's very interesting. Some companies are identified with this, some are not. I'd never heard the name General Motors linked with Soviet trade until Wall Street Journal last week. Apparently, they've finally given way. Up to now, the last 50 years, has been Ford, General Electric, DuPont, Gleason, but not, up to now, General Motors, not Chrysler, not American Motors. International Harvester, yes. Caterpillar Tractor, no. Radio Corporation of America, RCA, yes. Hewlett-Packard up to recently? No. Well, of course, it's a fairly recent company. But Bell Telephone, certainly no. In other words, you can pinpoint specific companies and you can trace their association over 50 years. Then, Chapter 5, I get into the direct supply of weapons. In other words, shipping weapons direct. And I think I have something here which I know has not been brought out before. And this is early 1918. The Bolshevik Revolution was the end of 1917. Early 1918, about all the Bolsheviks had, they had Petrograd and they had Moscow, and they were lucky to hold that. They almost lost that in March. They had a very, very tenuous hold on Russia in early 1918. But what did I find in the State Department files? I found that American munitions were being shipped to the Bolsheviks in early 1918. Not only that, they wanted credit. Let me quote. This is from a State Department document. This, I'm sure, is the first time this has ever been published. Quote, "Munitions that are now being evacuated from Archangel are sent to Moscow, the Urals, and Siberian towns. Soviet government desires to take up the matter of payment for these munitions and expects to pay for them in raw materials, but asks for time to organize the economic resources of the country." That sounds like 1973. Anyway, we go on like this. I've dug out some more documents, I'm sure not previously published. One I know will interest you, I think, and that is 1938, President Roosevelt's secret agreement with the Soviets. Only four people know about this in the United States and only four in Russia. Now, what caught my attention was that President Roosevelt was talking about each power pursuing separate and independent courses about to the same objective. And I didn't quite catch on to that at first, but it recorded in my mind, and then I dug it up later. Let me read what President Roosevelt... this is a report, by the way, by Ambassador Davis about this agreement between Roosevelt and Stalin, known to only four people in the United States, and none in Congress, four in the executive branch, and four in the Soviet Union. Quote, this is Ambassador Davis reporting on this. "It would be the part of prudence and wisdom on the part of each government to familiarize the other with facts which might be of substantial value in the future by reason of similarity of purposes and necessities, even though each power were pursuing separate and independent courses." At that very time, the Soviets were stoking up a war in Spain. They were certainly murdering their own people. That was the year when they killed, I think, 10,000 officers in the Red Army. And here we get President Roosevelt talking about similarity of purposes and a common objective. So, just at random, we go on then to a section on, we get down to the technical aspects then. For example, I got a section on Soviet missiles, the fact that they are using American accelerometers and how the accelerometers got there. And how the ball bearings, the miniaturized ball bearings, which you need for a missile, the company that Bryant Chuck and Grinder Company in the United States that sold this equipment. Congress itself said this was a matter of life and death to the United States. It was a tragic error to ship these. The shipment was stopped in the early 60s, but it was released very recently by President Nixon. In spite of the fact that Congress said this is a matter of life and death, President Nixon released the export of these particular machines for machining the races on miniature ball bearings, which is something the Soviets had never been able to do. In fact, I think there's only one company in the United States can do it. So they get more missiles that way. Then we go through other chapters. The Russians at sea, I look at their navy. In the air, I point out, for example, that the MiG-15 had a Rolls-Royce engine. And in fact, Soviet jet engines do derive from, they're two separate derivations. One goes back to the Rolls-Royce Neen and the Derwent, the Tay, in the late 1940s, and the other from BMW and Junkers, two different series. And then I've got a chapter here on Congress and the bureaucrats. We spend $5 billion a year on intelligence, and apparently we don't know what's going on. I give examples of false statements made by Congress to the to Congress, not so far as I know to the administration. Then chapter 13, I ask the obvious question, why have we done this? I don't come to a definite answer because I don't frankly know. But I give you six alternate answers and you can take your choice. One, it's going to build a peaceful world. It's detente. If we mellow the Russians, they'll come to love us, and we'll all live happily thereafter. So far as I know, nobody has ever said that détente includes the shipment of military goods or includes the build-up of their military structure. In any event, I'll quote you, of all people, Arthur Schlesinger in the Wall Street Journal last week, where Arthur Schlesinger said that the core of détente is intellectual freedom. There is no intellectual freedom in the Soviet Union. There is no détente. It's a sheer illusion. So I kind of rule that one out, obviously. Then it could be an accident. Maybe the policymakers in Washington are dumber than most pessimistic of us think they are. You know, you go look at the wheat deal. What did they do? They increased the wheat export subsidy from 1 cent to 47 cents a bushel while they're selling the wheat to the Russians, and the Russians had nowhere else to buy it. Now, I don't know how much dumber you have to be than that, if it's an accident. So anyway, it could be an accident. You can make that case. Then I say, well, there's another possibility. Maybe we have no policy at all. Maybe it's what I call pragmatism. Policy is decided by random events. It's a kind of a cork floating around in the river, bobs around. Then I say, well, perhaps the time horizon for politicians is yesterday in the past and the next election in the future, and they just don't think about anything else. You talk about a 50-year spread of history, that's too much for a politician. Maybe this is the problem. And then I go after Mr. Kissinger, and I say, well, perhaps, because he is the architect, he took up what Walt Rostow started to develop, and I say, well, possibly Kissinger is a mystic. Now, I use mystic here in a very limited sense. A mystic to me is someone who cannot derive logical, rational answers from observable, empirical observation. In other words, he imagines things, and he imagines that what he imagines is the truth. Now, I quote in here a statement from Kissinger's book, in which he apparently does operate in this manner. You make your own decision. You read what I say about Kissinger. It could be that he just imagines in some way that there is no possible connection between trade and their military structure. When it's pointed out to him, he just doesn't want to believe it. It's not part of his makeup. I do know this, that Kissinger knows nothing about economics and even less about technology. So you take a choice on that one. Then I look at conspiracy, and particularly, of course, Gary Allen. And there what I've done, I think for quite obvious reasons. You're lucky to survive anywhere in the academic world with an outlook like mine. You just do not survive if you say everything you think. I think Gary's got a lot going for him, though I'm not about to say so publicly, because I like to eat. I quote Nicholas von Hoffman, Washington Post. You might think he's a liberal, but there was a time when Nicholas von Hoffman would have me crawling up the wall, but I began to read behind him. And if you have a little patience sometimes, read a little behind what Nicholas von Hoffman is saying. And I used Nicholas von Hoffman's commentary on Gary Allen, and it was a very good commentary, and made some very good points. Anyway, a conspiracy is a possible alternative. Then you've got treason. I dismiss treason because legally there has to be proof that there was an intent to commit treason. I can't show that there was any intent. Anyway, the point is, and I'll better come to a conclusion now and perhaps get your questions. Whatever the reason, the facts point to one single, quite extraordinary conclusion, that our policy has been to build up the Soviet Union and the military strength of the Soviet Union. It could be that we are implementing Walt Rostow's recommendations back in the mid-1960s, where he recommended that as deliberate policy, we reduce American power and encourage the increase of Soviet power. Now, I never did understand his reasons for that, but I do understand that the Rostow papers do make this recommendation. Kissinger, of course, was associated with Rostow, and it could be that they have implemented this. If this is the case, you better take another look at the Walt Rostow papers, because there's more to come down the road. What's to be done about it? I don't know. I feel right now that I'm sitting out on an end of a limb. I'm waiting for the explosion. I know there's going to be an explosion because I know the reaction of the Hoover Institution to national suicide when they first saw the proofs. I think the most important thing is not the obvious thing. You and probably everybody else is going to expect me to say, cut off trade. No. I don't think that's the way. I think there's more involved in this than trade. I think we've got the corner of a much bigger story, and this story has got to come out in the open. Operation Keelhaul is part of it, and there are other parts of this story. The most important thing, I think, is to get the files opened. And the one strong recommendation I make in National Suicide is that the limit of classification should be 3 years. After 3 years, all government papers become public information. Because I am quite convinced if the public knew what was going on, this would not be tolerated. I just cannot believe that the average American wants the United States to commit suicide. So the absolute number one priority is information, more information, and then I would leave it up to the man in the street, the average American, to exert pressure through Congress. And I'm not saying cut off trade. I think that's a phony fight. You're not going to win it anyway, because the Export Control Act of 1949 was never implemented. The State Department never recommended cut-off aid to those countries supplying strategic goods to the Soviet Union. They always found a weasel out. If you're a bureaucrat, you can always find a way out if you want to. What I'm saying is, number one, let's get the files open. Let's find out what's going on. That's the most important thing. I can't do very much more. I've done, frankly, about as much as I can do. The rest is up to people like yourself. Secondly, Congress has to reassert itself. There's flagrant abuse of the Constitution. You'll recognize by my accent that I'm a naturalized citizen. I took an oath of allegiance to the Constitution, and frankly, all I can see day after day are flagrant breaches of the Constitution, the Internal Revenue Service being one of the worst offenders. And thirdly, I rather hesitate to make this point at this meeting, but I will make it anyway, because I think that you pretty well summed me up by this time. You've got a pattern of what motivates me. I don't tend to hold things back. I think that perhaps our way of looking at things as being left and right is leading us into traps. What do? We look at someone and we say, is he left or is he right? This political spectrum, I think, is beginning to evolve in my mind that it is evading the real issue. The real issue, as I see it coming up in the next 5 or 10 years, is the individual trying to preserve his rights under the Constitution as it was originally intended against a collectivist state. I see the issue in terms of the individual versus the state, not in terms of left and right. Now, this may or may not to you sound like heresy. I've never put this argument to a fully conservative audience before. I think this is what we're going to have to face up to. At that point, perhaps I should catch your questions and then we'll stay within the time limit.
Current information on the recent the energy crisis, the energy crunch, the vast Russian oil fields, the support, our relationship with them, any observations you might have in that area?
The energy crisis, so far as I can see it, is a phony. Take a look at the Department of Commerce, U.S. Statistical Abstract Reserves of Natural Gas in the United States. You find they've increased by 50% since 1950. I think this year's output of natural gas is about 7% of total reserves. We have twice as much gas in the ground in the United States as has been produced in the whole history of production of natural gas going back to the late 19th century. What caused the apparent shortage You go back to the Natural Gas Act of 1938, which gave the government the right to intervene. You take the 1954 Phillips Petroleum decision, which put a ceiling on natural gas prices. And, of course, this reduced incentive for natural gas producers to produce the gas, so you get a shortage. Anytime you interfere with a laissez-faire economy, you're going to get problems. This natural gas shortage was created, obviously, by government interference. Crude oil, I wrote a paper back in 69 in which I predicted almost exactly what has happened. I'm going to have to dig that paper up. I even predicted, I think, the Libyan situation. I've got actual empirical proof that my projection was right there, that we should have lifted import quotas a long time ago. That covers your two main. Of course, then you've got the environmentalists as well.
But this heavy influx of American technology now being mm-hmm. talked about to the Russian area, so we will yeah. develop the field, we'll put yeah. together the refineries. Is this another similar to the steel business?
Well, yes, but the estimates are that Siberian natural gas is going to cost about anywhere between 2 and 4 times as much as Texas gas. It can only be done if you get credits from the Import-Export Bank, and I presume that will be done. It is a parallel to the situation of the 1930s. There's little question about that. It makes us dependent on Soviet gas. There's supposed to be mutual dependency, but look at it this way. Supposing the Soviets don't like us making a noise, for example, about Soviet Jews. They just turn the taps and cut off the gas. We're left high and dry without gas. Sure, we're dependent on them. But what about if we ship technology in there? They can use that for 20 years, for 30 years. You can't just pull that technology back. In other words, what we've committed ourselves is to a very wonderful thing. In other words, that our shipment of technology there is vital to them and is irreversible. But what they ship back is reversible in the sense they can cut it off any time they want to. So we get absolutely the worst end of the deal. There's no question about that. By the way, on the SALT Treaty, talking about bad deals, that one, I've got a little section on that. That one is almost unbelievable. Each country, Soviet Union and United States, gets 2 ABM systems, and each capital country gets 1 system, and they can put the other system anywhere they want. So the American system goes in Washington, and the Soviet system goes in Moscow. But what have you got in Washington? If there was a threat of nuclear attack, you evacuate the bureaucrats, and all you got left is a lot of stones and waste paper. So, all right, drop all the bombs you want on it. But what if you got in Moscow? You've got the most important section of the military-industrial complex. Their main plants are in Moscow. So what you've exchanged here, it must be brilliant to bring this about, you've exchanged defense of nothing for defense of the most significant part of the Soviet military-industrial structure. Now, I can't think of anything much crazier than that. I'm sorry I got off the track, but it just reminded me of that one. Yes, sir?
On what basis do you say that, do you assume that we all divide everything into right and left?
Excuse me, sir. I did not. The question is, by the way, on what I said about right and left. I did not mean to imply that that you were individually doing it. But frankly, how I usually use that is not in relation to American political parties at all. It frankly doesn't enter into the picture here. Where I think it's got to be used is in a broader scale, where you're talking about national socialism on the right and international socialism being communism on the left. It's that broader political spectrum. In fact, Gary Allen in his book has got something very similar to what I'm saying, if not the same. He's got that spectrum, and I think Gary in his book says that the left-right spectrum is misleading. You've got to look at it in terms of a degree of centralization of power, which is exactly what I'm trying to say. Those two little diagrams in Gary Allen's book are exactly what I'm trying to say. Yes?
I have a question about how can we take a picture of complete trade?
No, please don't. You've made me think that perhaps we're further along the road than I thought. See, I'm at the end of a research project. And the conclusion in my mind is we're not going to solve this thing by clamping down on trade. I think we can do it with more information. Now, that's a long, long way from developing policy. What are we going to do? And there's got to be all kinds of discussion between what I've arrived at and where you actually go. Maybe we can't do it just by opening up the files. Maybe we've got to clamp down on trade. In other words, my mind is wide open. But the point is, I'm at the end of a research stage, and I have these ideas developed. But this is a long way. If you're thinking in terms of resolutions, don't. No, please. I mean, let's get some policy out of this. And this thing's now got to be kicked around and see, where do you go from here? It may be you have to cut off trade and... But fire the bureaucrats you've got and get some you can trust. Maybe that's the way to go. Next step is definitely information. In other words, hold as you are with trade. You know, hold with the clamping down on trade as a temporary position. But no, don't commit yourself to it for 50 years, I would suggest. But information is vital. You've got to find out what kind of deals have been made with the Soviet Union. That's vital. Because I suspect the worst. I suspect they've sold the thing out just lock, stock, and barrel. Now, that's my suspicion. Yes, sir. Operation Keelhaul was 1945-1946, where I don't know how many, at least several hundred thousand Russians who were then in Europe were forced to go back to the Soviet Union. They were forced by American and British troops to go back, and there are still graves in Austria on the bank of the River Drava of 142 Russians who committed suicide rather than go back to the Soviet Union. Now, this was a flagrant violation of the Geneva Convention, because paragraph 33 of the Geneva Convention just flatly disallows does not allow you to force someone back when he doesn't want to go. You can claim political exile. And so these people probably ended up in Siberia. We're still doing it. If you think of the Lithuanian seaman Kudirka, who jumped from a Soviet ship to an American Coast Guard cutter in American territorial waters just 2 years ago, and the Coast Guard commander, under instructions from Washington, allowed the Soviets to come on board an American naval vessel in U.S. territorial waters. They beat the Lithuanian sailor and dragged him back on the Soviet ship. That's another flagrant violation. Now, I'd like to see the papers on that. Anyone? You're the only one, Ron.
Excuse me.
That was Epstein, Julius Epstein. I don't think he's there any longer. Julius Epstein has spent many years, 15 years, working on that. He knows more about it than anybody else. I came into it because I could see what he was doing. He was doing that, what I was trying to do in Western technology. So every chance I get, I just mention it to make sure that as many people as possible know about it. But he is the man on Operation Keelhaul. Yes?
Do you think the present hearings of Watergate and the grand jury indictments and the special investigator and all this, do you think this is going to lead to any declassification?
I'm not optimistic. I know Mr. Nixon has said that this is going to be an open administration, open information. But he also said the taxes weren't going to be raised and a number of other things. In other words, I don't think that they will change one little bit until they are forced to change. And it is going to take a great deal of public pressure through Congress. I just do not think they're going to change voluntarily, for good reason. I have read something like over 10, 15 years, perhaps 250,000 State Department documents, either read or scanned them. And if that material had come out at the time, for example, Colonel House cabling Wilson, at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, suppress criticism of the Bolsheviks in American newspapers. If that had come out in 1917, imagine the uproar that would have created. And I think the same thing is going on today. I don't know, but I suspect. I don't think they will do it voluntarily. I think it's going to take a great deal of public effort. But I do think it is vitally important. Yes, sir?
What makes you think that the doctors
there are examples of policy being used in that manner. In other words, if you want to bring about something, you've got to have a kind of a wall to batter up against to bring it about. It's the Marxian, you know, thesis and antithesis brings about a synthesis. There is no question in my mind that the so-called international bankers are very much in the middle of this thing. There is a group, I call it the establishment. It seems to be a transatlantic establishment, and I know that because I have English sources. There's a transatlantic link, there's no question about this. It pretty well controls policy, there's no question about that. Whether you call yourself a Republican or a Democrat, the same people that Kissinger was under, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. They're pretty well running the show. But it's going to take an awful lot more work to get the full picture out. I don't think we've scraped the surface. But what I do know, look, basically I'm a researcher. This is my job. I'm a technician. I do know there is a much bigger picture, and the picture I've got is only a little part of it. There's a lot more under the surface. No question about that. Do you want to...